Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as The New York Times, The News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. We are fortunate to have in the studio today Larry Solomon. Larry recently moved back to the Research Triangle area from Washington, D.C., where he worked for almost 30 years as a scientist in program evaluation and public policy analysis for such government agencies as National Cancer Institute, the Government Accountability Office, GAO, and the National Institutes of Health, NIH. And of special relevance to this program, Larry has prior and current experience as a radio DJ. He has agreed to help read and share his insights with us here at TRRS. Welcome to Music Review, Larry. Well, thank you again for visiting with us here in the studio, Larry. It's really great having you and your family back in the Triangle area after all these years. What has it been, 30 years since we first worked together at NCSU?
Yeah, so that was in the late 1980s.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm glad we've kept up with each other since then, and I look forward to hearing more about your musical insights and experiences in the interview portion of this program. I also appreciate your willingness to assist in the reading of some of the sections of today's program. So let's start out with some musical trivia and transitions.
Sure, let's do it.
Okay, then. Our trivia questions come to us today from the websites funtrivia.com and songfacts.com.
Question number one. One of the better-known hits by Crosby, Stills, and Nash is Sweet Judy Blue Eyes. This song was written by Stephen Stills as a love poem for which 1960s folk music diva. Hint, this folk singer was known for such hits as Both Sides Now. And here's a snippet from another one of her better-known hits, Send in the Clowns.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, you in midair. Where are the clowns?
Sound familiar? So, who is this 1960s folk singer who inspired Stephen Stills to write the song Sweet Judy Blue Eyes? Was that A, Joan Baez, B, Judy Collins, C, Carole King, or D, Joni Mitchell?
One who keeps tearing around, one who can't move.
And question number two, this being our last program before Halloween, we would be remiss if we didn't include something about this holiday. Hence, what was the name of the spooky song initially sung by the performer Screaming Jay Hawkins in 1957? Hence, Hawkins developed a bizarre stage show about his attempt to win a girl over. He would come out in a flaming coffin and wield a skull on a stick that he named Henry. Lots of singers covered this song, but North Carolina native Nina Simone not only recorded it, she named her autobiography after this song title. So what is the title of this spooky song? Is it A, Thriller, B, Spirit in the Sky, C, Somebody's Watching Me, or D, I Put a Spell on You? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from the website onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of October 26th.
Well, it was 62 years ago today, 1956, that Elvis Presley became the first artist to follow himself into the number one position on the Billboard Pop Hit charts. His previous number one was Don't Be Cruel, Hound Dog, and his follow-up number one was Love Me Tender, 1956.
And it was on this day, back in 1998, that jazz singer Peggy Lee suffered a stroke and was hospitalized. Tragically, she was left mute from the stroke. 1998. Let's turn our attention now to you, Larry. What were your major musical influences growing up in Charlotte?
Well, as a young teenager in the late 60s, I was heavily influenced by the protest music and socially relevant music and rock and roll of that time that was played on the so-called underground FM radio stations. So I would say Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Young, of course, Jefferson Airplane, Emerson, Lincoln, Palmer, yes, and other bands like that.
Mm-hmm. Led Zeppelin and things.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay. So how did you begin your radio announcing?
I started as a freshman at NC State, right here in Raleigh, and wandered over to the student station, which is WKNC, still on the air today. Uh-huh. And they hired me, and they let me do the news and then let me do music. And I moved on from there. When I went to Tennessee, I continued to work in broadcasting on a part-time basis while I was in college.
Uh-huh. And so that was at University of Tennessee in
That's right.
Knoxville.
That's
okay.
right.
Yeah, well, what was it about CSN? Why? In general, and David Crosby in particular, that got you interested in their music?
Well, their music was socially relevant. I mentioned that earlier, and I think that that's what attracted me, because so much of the music of the time was really devoid of any meaning at all, but uh-huh. their music was really about the times, Kent State, Vietnam, other things along those lines. So that's what really attracted me to that music.
Yeah, okay. Well, I understand that Mama Cass Elliott of the Mamas and Papas was somewhat responsible anyway for bringing Crosby, Stills, and Nash together. Is that true?
That is one popular story, and Joni Mitchell apparently also played a role. So uh-huh. there's the debate remains, even among the band members today, there's still a debate about that.
I see.
Right?
Well, they actually recorded something, didn't they, at Joni Mitchell's house?
That's right. They yeah. did. In the Morning When You Rise... was the beginning lyric of that song. You Don't Have to Cry, the name of the tune.
I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. Good. Well, let's hear a snippet from Crosby, Stills, and Nash's and Young's work. This is For What It's Worth.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
So what's your reaction to this song, For What It's Worth, Larry?
It was all about the times in the 60s, about Sunset Strip and about anti-war protesters and uh-huh. people looking at the police, or they, I guess Stephen calls them the heat in the song.
Uh-huh.
It really did reflect the times.
Yeah. One of the things I'm struck by with this particular song is it seems to describe a period of confusion and
right.
sort of reminds me of... like Bob Dylan and some of the stuff, Ballad of a Thin Man and things like that, which you're standing there trying to figure out what it is that's going on around you, making it very confusing, somewhat similar to perhaps how a lot of people feel today even.
Exactly.
Now, you've actually met David Crosby, haven't you? How'd that come about?
Several times, but the first time I met him was I was involved in a political group in the Washington, D.C. area years ago called Voters for Choice, and they held a benefit concert. And for those of us who were involved, we had the ability to go to a meet and greet before the show. So mm-hmm. David Crosby was there along with some other musicians like Graham Nash and Jackson Browne. So that was my opportunity. It was a really exciting thing for me to be able to do.
Mm-hmm. And you actually have a picture of you standing there with David Crosby as well, right?
Right, I sure do.
Yeah, and you were able to ask him some questions about music?
I asked him questions about, he's talked for years about bringing one of his earlier bands, which is the Byrds, back together.
Oh, yeah.
He would love to do that, but unfortunately, Roger McGuinn, who was also in the band and sort of the leader of the band, is resistant to the idea, but we would still love to hear it if they could do it.
Oh, that would be good, yeah. Now, Larry, since you're now quote-unquote retired, you're still working, of course, some, you've been able to return to the Triangle area with your lovely family, Lisa and Maya. Tell us about your daughter, Maya.
Maya, we adopted from China about 6 years ago, and Maya has a special need in an albinism, of course, which is a vision issue, a lack of pigment, causing issues with really being able to see in a very defined way. It's a little grainy for her vision. Uh-huh. So, but she does very, very well. She has a lot of support at school. She has a lot of friends. She's a very bright kid and really functions quite well with some social support. So you would never know that she had this issue, but she does have a vision issue that's easily not cured, but certainly managed. And mm-hmm. I think that's the key here.
Yeah, I think you described it as sort of a fuzzy black and white TV screen.
Sort of like the old style cathode ray tube televisions versus what we watch today, the high definition televisions. That's the easiest way to explain the condition. It's something that will not get worse. It might even get better over time.
Okay. Right. Is there some color vision loss as well?
No, it's mostly just definition and having to hold books closer to you and that sort of thing.
I see. Yeah. Okay. There's some organization, national, I guess, maybe international, NOAA?
Yeah, NOAA's National Organization for Albinism and Hypopigmentation, which I attend their meetings. My wife and I and Maya, too, go to their every meetings every 2 years and the conferences, and we learn all about the condition and what research is being done and ways to help support people with this condition. So you see tons of people from around the country attending every 2 years, and we learn so many things, and we really enjoy going.
Hmm, interesting. I came across this article recently about using music and song to unite those family with albinism as a social movement to educate and advocate. And so let me just start out with that, Larry, and then I'll let you go ahead and finish that article up. It's entitled Hunted and Hated, People with Albinism Speak Out and Sing Out. This is written by Jackson Sinnenberg and published in NPR.org on the 16th of June, 2017. It's hard to imagine that Africans would record and release an album of music with the name White African Power, but that is the title of an album released this month by the Tanzanian Albinism Collective, a group of amateur musicians from Africa who have albinism, a rare genetic condition that results in a lack of pigment in skin, hair, or eyes. According to the National Organization for Albinism and Hypopigmentation, NOAA, albinism occurs in about 1 in 18,000 to 20,000 people in the U.S. In other parts of the world, it could be as high as 1 in 3,000, NOAA says. The title of the album is meant to be ironic, to create a sense of discomfort, explains Ian Brennan, the producer who brought the musicians together. The songs are meant to be pure vehicles for the writer's self-expression. White African Power is the newest in a string of projects produced by Brennan that seek to give voice to people who are normally voiceless. The whole intention, says Brennan, is to hear from individuals, the invisible, and learn from them. So, our only directive was, what do you want the world to know? Christina Wagalu, a singer and songwriter on the album, wanted the world to know that for her, life is hard.
Salif Keita is another person with albinism who takes a public stand. He's probably the most famous person with albinism in the world. Born in Mali, Keita is a global Afro-pop star who has devoted much of his musical career to raising awareness for albinism. In 2005, he founded the Salif Keita Global Foundation to bring attention to the medical and social conditions that people with albinism face. On a Sunday night in April, he was greeted with rock star levels of adulation by a sold-out crowd at the Fillmore in Silver Spring, Maryland. There was no stigma, no discrimination against him because of the color of his skin, only joy and love. But that's clearly not always the case. There is a growing movement that encourages people with albinism to raise their voices, to speak out and sing out against their mistreatment. And while the act of protest is important, the therapy, the personal transformation that comes from performing may be even more so. Music allowed me to see that life is possible and everybody is here for a mission, Keita said after his Silver Spring benefit concert. Christina Wagalu makes the undeniable point that for people with albinism, life is hard, but White African Power doesn't end with a song of despair. It ends with Teresa Pinea's song, Happiness, asserting her pride in her identity. She sings, "Here We Are on the Stage, Tanzania Albinism Collective Members."
Mm-hmm. Well, Larry, I've listened to your wonderful two-hour Sunday evening radio broadcast on low-power FM station WCOM from Carrboro. Tell us something about that experience and its relation to the future of radio.
Well, back in the 90s, there was a lot of deregulation in the radio business in this country, and a lot of corporations were able to buy a lot of stations and basically homogenize the whole radio business. So there were a lot fewer local owners and a lot less community involvement. So stations like WCOM and Carrboro, or low-power FM community stations, started to be allowed to occur by the FCC, and they are in touch with communities as opposed to being, you know, corporate-level type organization. So we serve the community. We serve people in the Carrboro Chapel Hill area with an over-the-air signal, but we also have a web stream as well on WCOMFM.org that anyone has an internet connection can listen to as well. So it's a great station. It gives the community something to bind to and something to have as a point of involvement.
I see. So this is, even though it's sort of a throwback to the way FM used to sound,
right,
it's not really something that's disappearing. If anything, it looks like the future is bright for these kind of stations.
Yes, there are more and more of them appearing, and a lot of communities have them. They have all kinds of different formats, but there are many of them in this country, yes.
Uh-huh. Well, I actually found an article here written by News and Observer Paul Gilster on the 17th of September, 2017, which is called "Future is Tricky for Traditional Radio Outlets," which seems to tie into this. He says, listening to distant stations doesn't keep local stations alive, and it's conventional AM-FM radio, what we all grew up with, that is threatened, according to a new report out from New York University. Is traditional radio, the stations that broadcast a signal over an antenna and fill up drive time hours for so many drivers, headed for an inevitable decline? People have always used radio as a way of finding new music, but the New York University survey, conducted by Steinhardt Music Business Program, points out that radio has fallen way behind digital services like Pandora, YouTube, and Spotify when it comes to exploring music. Streaming music is now used by Billboard to produce its popularity charts. These, in turn, are becoming more of a factor in determining what radio stations play than traditional airplay. Traditional radio is what I turn to when I need something fast, a news flash or the movement of a hurricane. The venue, then, is stable enough. There should always be a place for local radio, with its mix of relevant commercials and updates on traffic and banter among people we might actually run into in nearby venues. That sense of being among neighbors is something streaming services don't convey, just as national websites don't put across an adequate picture of our hometowns. Music is what commercial radio thrives on, but the digital train is approaching the intersection. Going forward, traditional radio will have to supplement its offerings with streaming and other digital options while moving away from the music discovery model that the internet has so thoroughly disrupted. A digital model focusing on local talk and connection to personalized services is evolving and redefines the DJ and should be fertile ground for startups to explore. What do you think of that, Larry?
I think it's right on the money. I think that there's a real struggle. We even see it in the stock prices of some of these national corporations. The stock prices are dropping rapidly.
Uh-huh.
So I think the financial markets are even reacting to this whole issue that there's a different way to handle music. I just bought a new car just last week, and Slacker. It has TuneIn radio. It has all of these functions. You can listen to music without listening to a local station, which, you know, is just, that's the wave of the future.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, have you noticed there's any kind of tendency towards fusion across musical genres?
There is, and there has been for a long time. It's hard to categorize a lot of music. I mean, I'm going back to my early influences when I was listening to music as a teenager, and even bands like Emerson, Lake and Palmer, And yes, there's classical and rock fused together.
Uh-huh.
In more recent times, people like Robert Plant have worked with Alison Krauss. There's a guy from Led Zeppelin working with a bluegrass person. So there's a real crossover there. But it's interesting how these things mix, yes.
Yeah. It's like I remember hearing at the IBMA festival here, the Kruger Brothers, they do a wonderful mix of bluegrass music and classical symphony orchestration. It's just beautiful. And, you know, Steely Dan coming back from the early 70s and so on. Once again, a wonderful fusion there of jazz and rock music as well. So, yeah, there seems to be a lot of that. Well, I actually have an example of that fusion that takes place. Let you take a listen to this first.
And there she's back in the atmosphere. I'm afraid that she might think of me. Yes, plain old Jane Doe, a story about a man who was too afraid to fly, so he never did land. But tell me, did the wind sweep you off your feet? Did you finally get the chance to dance along the light of day? Get back to the Milky Way.
Drops of Jupiter by Train introduces our rock and pop music news, and it's an article entitled Pat Monahan, frontman of rock band Train, will make Broadway debut in Rocktopia, written by Andy Lekovitz, and it's published on the 16th of January 2018 in Broadway.com. Pat Monahan, the Grammy-winning and multi-platinum-selling lead singer of the pop rock band Train, will make his Broadway debut for the first 3 weeks of the run of Rocktopia, the previously announced musical event fusing 20th century rock with classical compositions. Will feature world-class vocalists backed by a full symphony orchestra, an electrifying rock band, and a choir performing the works of musical innovators including Journey, Mozart, Queen, Handel, U2, Tchaikovsky, Hart, Beethoven, Led Zeppelin, Copland, The Who, and more. Rocktopia makes its Broadway premiere at the Broadway Theater. The entire Rocktopia team is thrilled to have Pat Monahan join us at the Broadway Theater. Pat's incredible talent and background lends itself perfectly to our unique musical vision, says Rob Evan, co-creator of Rocktopia. The fusion we have created with Train's song for the encore is truly exciting. As founder and lead singer, Pat Monahan has led Train to great success. The band has sold more than 10 million albums worldwide and more than 30 million tracks with multiple platinum gold citations, including 3 Grammys and 2 Billboard Music Awards. As part of Rocktopia, Monahan will perform multiple songs, including Kashmir by Train's musical inspiration, Led Zeppelin. Regularly covering Led Zeppelin music in live shows, Train recorded a cover of the album Led Zeppelin II in 2016. And once again, that song playing in the background was Drops of Jupiter by Train.
So, how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, Sweet Judy Blue Eyes, was written by Stephen Stills as a love song for which 60s folk music diva? Hint, the 60s folk singer rose to fame with such hits as Both Sides Now, and I played a snippet of her singing Send in the Clowns. A, Joan Baez, B, Judy Collins, C, Carole King, or D, Joni Mitchell. Correct answer? Answer B, Judy Collins. This song wasn't CSN's first single or even their biggest, but certainly one of Crosby, Stills, and Nash's most well-known songs. It established the harmony style that would be the group's trademark for years to come. This song started out as a love poem that kept growing. Stephen Stills can fill an album with his songs of lost loves, unrequited loves, failed loves, and mistaken loves. Fortunately, he has been able to stay attached and faithful to his first love, music. And as noted in songfacts.com, Stephen Stills wrote this about his then-girlfriend, folk singer Judy Collins. In their 1991 box set, Stills said, "It started out as a long narrative poem about my relationship with Judy Collins. It poured out of me over many months and filled several notebooks. I had a hell of a time getting the music to fit. I was left with all of these pieces of song, and I said, let's sing them together and call it a suite, because they were all about the same thing, and they led up to the same point." This song, by the way, opened Crosby, Stills, Nash's set at Woodstock in 1969.
And the answer to our second question, what was the name of the Halloween song initially sung by the performer Screaming Jay Hawkins back in 1957? Hints. Hawkins developed a bizarre stage show about his attempt to win a girl over. He would come out in a flaming coffin and wield a skull and a stick that he named Henry. Lots of singers covered this song, but NC native Nina Simone not only covered this song, she named her autobiography after this song title. So what's the title of this spooky song? Was that A, Thriller, B, Spirit in the Sky, C, Somebody's Watching Me, or D, I Put a Spell on You? And the correct answer is, in fact, answer D, I Put a Spell on You. As noted in songfacts.com, Screaming Jay Hawkins wrote this 1957 hit as a ballad lamenting the loss of a girlfriend he wanted back. The song became a spooky tale about putting a curse on the girl so he can have her. Hawkins performed the ghoulish version for the first time at a Christmas concert staged by Cleveland DJ Alan Freed in 1956. He got a huge reaction from the song, and Freed invited him to perform it on his TV special. The producers wanted a weird-sounding record, so they gave the musicians lots of food and liquor and created a party atmosphere at the session. The version with various grunts and groans was banned by most radio stations. An edited version became a hit with teenagers who liked the forbidden sound. It became a very popular Halloween song. Popular cover was by Nina Simone, an influential singer who performed a variety of standards and jazz songs before her death in 2003. Her 1991 autobiography is titled, I Put a Spell on You. So let's close out today's program with North Carolina native Nina Simone's cover of this spooky holiday Halloween tune, I Put a Spell on You. And thank you again, Larry Solomon, for your time on our program today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Put a spell on you. Cause you're mine. Do, 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 do. You better stop the things you do.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website, TriangleReadingService.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me. Randy Thompson at 919-832-5138. So long. Until next time.